Welcome to JAT Chat, presented by the Journal of Athletic Training, the official journal of the National Athletic Trainers Association. My name is Chris Coons, and I'm the Associate Editor for Digital Applications at the Journal of Athletic Training. I'll be hosting tonight's event. The purpose of the event is to provide an open forum for athletic trainers and allied health professionals to ask questions and discuss the upcoming National Athletic Trainers Association position statement on facilitating work-life balance in athletic training practice settings. This important paper will be released later in the month, and we thought this would be a great time to talk with the lead author of the paper, Dr. Stephanie Mazerol. Dr. Mazerol is an associate professor and the clinical coordinator of the Katie-accredited undergraduate program at the University of Connecticut. In order to make tonight's event as smooth as possible, we'd ask that you submit any questions you may have in the Facebook Live comment section or as a tweet at JAT_NATA using the hashtag JATChat, all one word. At this point, I'd like to introduce Dr. Stephanie Mazerol and thank you for taking the time to speak with me at this late hour.
Thanks, Chris.
If you wouldn't mind, would you introduce yourself and just provide a little bit about your background, maybe what your research interests or clinical interests are, and maybe how you came to be asked to lead the effort to write this paper?
Yeah, sure. So I did my undergraduate work at the University of Connecticut. I did my master's degree at Old Dominion University, and then my PhD work at UConn again. I joined faculty 13 years ago. I was the program director to begin with, and then kind of transitioned to support the program and were in a clinical coordinator role and assisting. We're transitioning to the master's program. So I academically advise all the freshmen that are marked pre-AT or pre-PT and kind of work with them in that capacity. I've worked at both the college and the high school settings clinically. I kind of came into work-life balance and retention factor issues through my dissertation. I was working a lot of hours like most athletic trainers do, and I was I'm talking to a lot of my students at the time when I was doing my doctoral work, and we really started talking about were they going to stay in the field and some of the factors that were leading them to think about not staying in the field after working for a degree. And a lot of that came up was I can't have a family, or I'm not going to have enough time to do the things I want to if I'm going to be an athletic trainer full time. So that kind of got me into thinking about work-life balance, and my dissertation really focused on that. And so my expertise is really in work-life balance and some of the other things that support the professional issues in athletic training, job burnout, mentoring, job satisfaction, those kinds of things.
Yeah, they all seem to go together pretty smoothly. That's a nice, well-rounded agenda. Absolutely. A question we've gotten from a lot of different people that we've spoken to over the last few weeks about this paper and also just this kind of area of development that the NATA goes through on a regular basis is, what is the process for developing a position statement for the NATA? About how long does it take? Who's involved? I'm sure you've thought about this more than you would have liked to at this point, and so I'm just wondering if you could give some detail for the viewers.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the pronouncements committee is where the idea comes to fruition. So they identify some hot topic areas in the field, and then once they agree that those are the areas they want to pursue, they identify individuals in the field that are considered experts. So I was approached by the pronouncements committee and said, we really like to do something that's unique. So most of the position statement, or all the position statements until now, really focus on patient outcomes and providing better care to the student athlete or the patient that the athletic trainer is providing care to. So this really focuses on the clinician itself. So once that's determined, they then ask you, once they ask you to chair the committee, to develop a writing team. So the process with the writing team is you're going to identify individuals that are also experts and that can support the process in writing it. Something that's unique to this position statement is that we want to make sure that we had someone that represented all of the employment settings that are currently practicing as athletic trainers. So if you see the list of authors, you'll see that there's someone in the emergent practice settings, a college setting, high school setting. So we really made sure that we included all individuals who are practicing clinically. So once that is the pronouncements committee approves the writing team, then you have a year to develop the paper. And then like all peer-reviewed publications, it goes out for external review. You then go ahead and make those edits. And then once the pronouncements committee approves it, it goes to the board of directors for approval. So a typical position statement can take 3 to 4 years to fruition from the time that the idea is developed all the way through to hopefully when it's in press.
Wow. It's a more complicated process than I think most people understand. And I'm sure there's enough ups and downs throughout the process that it's frustrating, but it seems to be worth it. Readers and the athletic training community really appreciate the effort, and it helps them to distill a lot of information down into one place that they can actually use in their clinical practice.
Right.
So I'm going to change course just a little bit. We had a really good question from one of the viewers that I think will actually help set up some of the other things that I'm sure you're hoping to talk to about this evening. And so one of the viewers asked, how do you define burnout in athletic training, and how do you know if you're experiencing it? And then from a graduate student perspective, I'm guessing this viewer was a graduate student, are there some things that graduate students specifically can do to try to prevent burnout before they've even had a chance to make it out into the workforce?
Right. Great question. So, you know, the thing with burnout is it's exposure to chronic stress. So the idea is that an individual is overworked for a long period of time. And where it differentiates from just being stressed is that they start to manifest physical symptoms. So they're more fatigued, they're exhausted, and then they start to lose interest in what they're doing. So in athletic training, when you're providing medical care, often what happens is the athletic trainer becomes disinterested in what they're doing. They have a harder time wanting to be at work. So then it reduces their productivity. They're not a good team player. And then there's some other things that can happen. They can, you know, have health related symptoms. So they're not sleeping as well, loss of appetite, and in some cases, depression. So generally speaking, prevention or recognition are the two key things, you know, ironically, as athletic trainers. So just being aware of when you're being overloaded and stimulated, being aware of the number of hours you're logging each week, and being sure you're able to communicate to your mentors, your advisors, or your supervisors that you have a lot on your plate. It's taking time for yourself every day and surrounding yourself with good people and having a good support network.
Great. Yeah, sometimes it's hard to set that time apart for yourself, but it is increasingly important as more gets put on your plate that you also take some time to set aside for yourself. It's the only way to get through those tough times, I think.
I agree.
Often in athletic training, we find ourselves, especially in the collegiate or secondary school setting, staying later than we expected, or taking work home, or often taking the stresses or emotions related to the work that we just did home with us. What are some ways to build boundaries and to try to stick to them as you're trying to transition from the work day to being at home with either family or other responsibilities you might have?
Right, so the idea of separation or disengagement is critical. Establishing boundaries. So for example, you know that every night you're gonna have family dinner at 6 p.m. So email, text, phone, whatever, that work goes away. So you create, you know, parameters of when that's going to be done. So, for example, I tell my students that after 9 p.m., if they text or email, I won't respond.
Sorry.
I know, it's past my bedtime. But they also will know that, between 4 a.m. and 7 a.m. that they will also get a response if they send the text message or email thereafter. And then I think the key piece to that whole equation in terms of creating boundaries and separation is that you have to stick to them. So if you're communicating that you're not available at 9 p.m., please don't respond to an email, text, phone call at 9:01. So they'll get the perception that your boundaries are permeable and that they can take advantage of that when they feel the need to. So sticking to your boundaries, clearly communicating what those are definitely important. In terms of creating that in the workplace. But in terms of disengagement, remember why you're doing those roles. Take a moment to reflect, you know, what you're doing, why you're doing it. Why do you love athletic training? So when you're being an athletic trainer, you're fully invested and you don't let spillover happen from other areas of your life. The same thing as if you're a mom or you're a spouse, like, you know, take that time to be disengaged from your athletic training role and really take value and enjoy the experience and be mindful in that moment when you're at home.
Great. This is actually a very interesting question that I had not thought about previously, and I think you may be able to shine some light or provide some context. So We had a viewer ask us about marriages between two athletic trainers versus a marriage between an athletic trainer and someone in a different field. And I guess the question was sort of, I don't think it has to be related to just marriages, maybe just relationships in life in general. Do you find that it's easier for individuals who have similar work-life issues that pop up to empathize and be able to work with each other to overcome those stresses? Or do you think it's easier for individuals who have someone who's disconnected from the profession to be able to go home to and sort of shut off the idea of being an athletic trainer for a while?
Right. So I think the question is simply answered. It doesn't matter if they're an athletic trainer or if they're a bank teller. I think the reality of it is communication. If I need to stay late to work this day, I'm communicating with my spouse or partner that that's what's happening. So clear communication is definitely important when managing relationships in athletic training. It's also finding a partner that's accepting of the athletic trainer lifestyle. So you'll often hear, athletic trainers talk about how their spouse demonstrates support, understanding, empathy in terms of their role. I'll give an example. So our women's soccer athletic trainer at the University of Connecticut, she's a mom of three. And she's clear that, you know, from July 31st to Thanksgiving time, her husband is the wife and the mom and the husband and the father, and that he really provides great support. He's understanding. He's okay with taking more of the load during her travel season or her in-season competition. And then once she normalizes to a more regular schedule, they balance out that responsibility. So he is not an athletic trainer, but he just demonstrates support and they work together in terms of a team. So I think success is being upfront and open early in your relationship about the expectations of the field of athletic training. You as the athletic trainer have to have some acceptance of the lifestyle, but also finding the right fit. So job fit, making sure that you feel like the workplace meets your needs personally and professionally. And then that, again, you find a partner that can be supportive of your career.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems I have enough colleagues and friends who have partners from every different profession you could possibly imagine. And it seems like early discussion and support is really what's important.
I think there's value, though, in having someone understand the nature of the beast. So, I mean, in some cases, marriages between athletic trainers work because they can be, empathetic and they understand those expectations.
Sure. So a question we've gotten a few different permutations or wordings of is what are, and it actually came up this weekend. We had Tori Lindley, the president of the NATA, was here on campus this last weekend giving a talk about kind of where the profession is headed and some goals for his time as president. And he was talking about really starting to set some hard barriers about when care is going to be delivered to patients or athletes, starting to limit ourselves to a work day that actually enables us to provide high quality and committed care instead of becoming stressed out by being at work and having that distract you from providing good healthcare services. I'm wondering, from a tangible strategy perspective, are there things that athletic trainers in traditional or non-traditional clinical settings can do to start to set boundaries with administrators or coaches to help them have a more reasonable work day and sort of cut down on those extra or extraneous hours that they seem to be putting in?
Yeah, I mean, it's simple. It's actually in the position statement, creating clear medical coverage policies in terms of these are the hours that athletic training services will be available. If you have you practice within those particular hours, then you'll receive coverage. Outside of those things, that you know what 911 is, you know how to communicate when you need to activate emergency services, you know what the emergency action plan and the coaching staff is brought into that. So it's having clear, established medical coverage and athletic training treatment hours provided and involving the coaching staff, the administration in the development of those policies. So when everyone has buy-in, the likelihood is that there's going to be more compliance and acceptance around those hours. And then on an individual level, again, it goes back to the boundaries. I talk a lot with my young athletic training students before they transition. You know, there's that expectation, the more hours I work, the more committed I am and the better athletic trainer I am, right? So the reality of it is, if I work an 7 to 8 hour day, and I've done all the things that are related to my job, then again, I'm doing a good job, and I'm still providing medical care during an appropriate time, and I'm not burning myself out because I'm there 10 to 12 hours. The idea is if we start doing that early, that expectation is going to be there, that I'm always available. And so when I try to scale back because I have other things I want to accomplish in my life, there's a question, well, you're not as committed or you're not doing a good job because now you're only working 8 or 9 hours versus the 12 or 13 you were giving before.
Yeah, that makes absolute sense. And I kind of want to go off of that answer. You said that, you know, that was one of the key recommendations in the position statement. Can you highlight a few of the other important recommendations or take-home points that clinicians or administrators may be able to take from the position statement?
Sure. So one thing, the way the position statement recommendations are organized is on two levels. The first one is organizationally based. So making sure that organizations have policies in place that are related to work-life balance. And then there's also individual level policies and recommendations. Again, that's from the individual's perspective. Like I am able, as an athletic trainer myself, I have policies and strategies to create balance. So a couple of them are to make sure that, you know, you're assessing the supervisors, assessing all staff members' workloads and making sure that they're able to address them and that there might be fair and consistent and open suggestions for improved work-life balance. To make sure that there is a development of policies that are related to work-life balance, so personal leave, sick time, vacation time. There are specific patient coverage hours about operation, traditional versus non-traditional coverage. There's also the importance for job sharing. So the idea of job sharing is that there's teamwork amongst coworkers. So if someone has an event that they want to go to, but their team is still practicing, they could ask a staff member to help cover the end of their practice so they can do that. And then that's reciprocated in another example that athletic trainer then can leave early to go to a doctor's appointment or get their oil changed in their car or go to a daughter's dance recital. So again, the idea of job sharing is that athletic trainers are all trained and credentialed and can provide the same level of care regardless of who it is. And so sharing that load within the workplace. Supervisors to help provide social and emotional support from employees. So it's the recognition and reward of an effort well done. So for example, our football team is on bye this week. So the head athletic trainer is making sure that our staff tomorrow when treatments are done are gone and they have almost 48 hours of no athletic training responsibilities. So they get 48 hours in the middle of the season to rejuvenate and kind of be ready to end the season. You know, they've been working 70, 80 hours a week. Mm-hmm. And so that's a nice opportunity. But it was a recognition of the head athletic trainer saying, hey, you know, this is something you've earned, and I recognize the hard work you're giving. On an individual level, making sure that you set boundaries in the workplace, we talked a lot about that, sticking to your guns and making sure you're communicating that to your staff or to your coworkers and your student athletes or your patients. Making sure that you prioritize yourself daily, so meaning that you take 30 minutes to exercise or you go read a book or you listen to music, whatever your personal interest is, that every time you write a to-do list for your daily tasks, one thing should be included to self-care or, you know, personal interests. And then making sure that you have personal and professional goals and that you're able to accomplish them. So maybe it's a new certification you want to get. It's wanting to run a marathon or whatever it may be. Having personal and professional goals helps keep you motivated and committed.
Great. Off of that topic, so this is actually, I was not expecting these questions, but I sent out an email to program directors that some program directors got about 15 times this last week, which I feel pretty bad about. But we asked that they promote this event for undergraduate students, and it seems like we've got some undergrads who are with us tonight. And we've gotten a few questions about what are some skills that undergraduate students can start to develop that you think may translate to later in the career, whether it's in graduate school or once they're out in the workforce. And are there things that undergraduate students, maybe through your experience as either a program director or clinical education coordinator or through your area of research, should start to try to develop at this point in their career because they will translate well in the future?
Sure. self-reflection. So taking the time to reflect on what is important to you. So when I give a lot of my work-life balance talks, I actually share the roles that I assume, you know, in my life. I'm a mom, I'm a runner, I'm a program director, whatever it may be. So having an identifying what your roles are in your life and how much time you want to prioritize each of them, how important they are, is important. So it requires a little bit of self-reflection to start. And then no one else is going to advocate for yourself but you. So if you're feeling overloaded, if you're feeling stressed out, early communication with, you know, staff, preceptors, peers, whoever it may be, it is definitely important. I think one thing that's really hard for athletic trainers in general is we're selfless. So it is important to take time for yourself and advocate for yourself, whether it's being that you want to exercise or you need to take a nap or getting whatever it may be. I think early on, early self-care and able to communicate needs and recognition of when you're overloaded is important. And the final one is being a good time manager, being able to manage your expectations, your responsibilities, and knowing what to do are critical.
Yeah, the time management piece is something that I don't think undergraduates necessarily understand what that means in totality sometimes. You know, it's about the immediate need or the immediate schedule, but not the overall structuring of the schedule or how to block time out for yourself and for other things. So that's really helpful.
I think the clinical immersion model, though, in the new master's program will help them see the totality of what the day-to-day athletic trainer's life is, and then they may be able to develop more effective time management strategies because they're seeing it. Because right now they're not seeing that, and they're only managing things in chunks of time.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a really strong rationale for one of the many rationales for that that piece of the degree transition plan. So something that has come up a few times is secondary schools are slightly different than a college environment where multiple clinicians are generally available and job sharing or role sharing may be more possible in the collegiate environment. In a lot of high school environments, it's one clinician, one full-time clinician, or maybe only a part-time clinician who's there to be able to provide care for all of the athletes who are engaged. And so, some of the folks who are watching have asked questions about, you know, how did things change for the secondary school. I wonder if we might use this as an opportunity to talk about how to make the case for additional support in the high school and what are some things that you can take to the admin that are related to not just clinical care, but also burnout and work-life balance for the clinician with the idea of getting some additional help.
Right. So, I mean, creativity. So the first thing is the idea of the informal network, right? So, you know, you're at the high school setting, secondary school setting, you have other colleagues who are working within your conference. So maybe it's that you establish travel policies, you know, they don't travel and you're able to take the load off that. A lot of our graduate assistants who have secondary school rotations, they have a per diem budget, so they're able to plan ahead if there's a couple times that they need to take time away for professional development, a family member's wedding, whatever it may be. So they have a professional development budget where they can hire a per diem athletic trainer to cover time. So again, it's the idea of job sharing, but they're paying someone else, and that's what in their budget, athletic training budget. It's communicating needs to your administrator of your overload, documenting the number of student athletes you're seeing on a daily basis so you can document the need for additional staff members. So it's maybe tracking a little bit more closely the number of hours you're putting in each week. And that's a good way to advocate in terms of that. Another concept that's not out there is workplace integration. So one of the benefits maybe at the secondary school setting is the win at all costs is not necessarily there in terms that it is in the collegiate setting. So at the secondary school setting, some of the benefits are is that maybe you get to bring your kid to work and they're able to see what you do and be involved on that level. It may be that your hours are a little bit different, so you're able to stay at home in the morning, and then when your spouse or partner comes home to take care of the kids. So there's some flexibility in the secondary school setting that can be utilized. But again, if you don't speak up and advocate for your needs, your administrative staff is not going to know that you're overwhelmed.
Sure. In some of your recent work, and not just the position statement, but other work that you've published recently, it's been notable that there are some gender role or gender differences in both the perceptions of burnout and reporting of the experience of burnout. I'm wondering if you could describe kind of the dynamics of that relationship between gender and burnout, and then maybe some rationale for why you think that might be occurring.
Right. So, well, so generally speaking, it goes to stereotyping. So women have the mindset that they are the person that should be providing parenting. They should be there the most in terms of domestic care. So the reality of it is that women, even if they are working less, but still feel that they're not able to be at every event, they often have what's called guilt, parent guilt, mom guilt. Right, so I have to be really good at an athletic trainer, and I have to be 100% at that job, and then I have to be 100% involved as a mom. And so that often is creating that difference. So men still want work-life balance, but there's that expectation that it's okay that they miss some activities because they often view themselves as the breadwinner, and I have to work to provide for my family. And if I'm able to get to these other events, then that's bonus. Where for a female, they want to work and they want to be a parent or a mom or whatever that may be, but they have a hard time balancing it or perceiving that they're balancing it because they haven't let go of the fact that they have to be good at both roles. So, you know, really the idea is that as long as you're doing a good job at everything, you're not going to be the best at everything. So it's kind of some stereotypical gender roles, unfortunately, but, you know, women sometimes have that superwoman mentality that they have to do it all and they don't delegate or they don't share to their spouse or partner. And so that's what often leads to the overload is not sharing the load or feeling the need to always be present at everything.
That makes a lot of sense. And it's something that I hope more dads and moms gain a bit of understanding and start to find some stakeholders who are able to provide some support. Can you talk about some of the limitations to putting together a position statement like the one that you've recently put together? What are some of the pitfalls, and what are some of the things that you maybe didn't know going into the process that ended up being more challenging or unsatisfying maybe?
Well, it's definitely a daunting task to collect all of the literature and then evaluate it that way. So the one thing that's unique about the work-life balance position statement is that a lot of the research is qualitative in nature. So it really assesses the perceptions of the professional issues and really doesn't quantify necessarily the experiences of work-life balance, burnout, job dissatisfaction, but it still offers that unique perspective, right? Because my work-life balance is going to be different than yours and someone else's. So that is a value in qualitative research, but unfortunately, the SORT system that's used to evaluate quantitative data does not necessarily give the same rigor to qualitative research as it deserves. So a lot of the recommendations are based on a C level, and that doesn't necessarily say that the scientific support isn't there. It just means that a lot of the research is qualitative nature, which is comparable to case studies, which receives a C level or C recommendation versus an A or a B.
Sure. And sort of going off of that, what are the areas that you found while doing this extensive literature search and putting together these recommendations that have glaring needs for additional investigation, either from academic or clinical researchers? I know we have a lot of graduate students who are currently watching and will be listening when we release this as a podcast next week. And they're always asking me what their, you know, some ideas for their thesis or for an upcoming project. And so what are some areas that they may be able to dig into to sort of help out with the next version of this statement?
Yeah, sure. Great question. So the first is more quantitative data. So we want to be able to quantify these experiences, how often it's happening, when it's happening. Work-life balance issues are cyclical in nature. So we really need more longitudinal data, again, with that quantifiable information. So that would be the first area, is continue to document that. The second is the idea of more of an individual level factor. So work-life balance is described as multifactorial, right? You have organizational things that impact work-life balance. Those are things you can't modify. You know, you're going to work long hours. You're going to have to travel. You're going to have a large student-athlete ratios to take care of. Those things aren't going to change, not modifiable. But individual factors are things such as your personality, your coping behaviors. So we don't have as much information on terms of how athletic trainers cope. Are they resilient? Are they hardy? And so those may help us better understand who is more likely to experience burnout, work-life balance, conflict, that kind of stuff. And so we can address it that way. So we need more research there. And then the final piece is this idea of the patient-centered model for care and delivery of athletic training services. So we need to understand, does organizational structure really impact the experience of work-life balance? Or is it really just a general sense of, whoever is supervising you and supporting the athletic trainer in terms of work-life balance?
I'm going to ask one more question, and then we're gonna end this for the evening, seeing as we've just hit 9:30 on the East Coast, and I know you're a early to bed person, and so am I. So we've had a few questions from individuals who are administrators, and they seem like they are very interested in improving work-life balance in their staff or in the individuals that they work or collaborate with, but it seems like they struggle to put together concrete policies or initiatives to be able to do that. And so I'm wondering, are there, I'm sure we've covered a few things already tonight, but if you were going to make a recommendation or two to an organizational leader, what would be some easy or maybe if they're not easy, but things that could be immediately or in the short term implemented that would have a noticeable or recognizable change?
Right. So, the first thing is giving supervisors autonomy or athletic trainers autonomy over their work schedules. So as long as they're able to address the needs of their patients and their student athletes, giving them the flexibility to decide when they come to work and when they leave is definitely critical. We know that when they feel more vested in that they have a ownership over their work schedule, they're more likely to have work-life balance. I think it's also, allowing coworkers and staff members to share the load. So if they, propose a model where one athletic trainer comes in the morning and another comes in the afternoon, supporting that. There are some athletic training services that do that where they are modeling more of a block scheduling. So like, I know Sacred Heart does it. I know Eastern Connecticut State Athletic Training does it. I also know BU does it. So the idea is that, individuals are coming in and covering a certain amount of time, and whatever's happening during that time, either they're going to soccer practice or maybe they're covering the athletic training room for the day. So maybe supporting something like that that is able to address the needs of that particular work setting. So I think, autonomy, work scheduling, and the also just work with the ramifications of what are happening within your work setting. So what works at UConn may not work at BU, what works at a high school may not work at private versus public. So I think being creative within your own athletic training practice setting is also helpful.
Well, I want to thank you very much for taking the time this evening to discuss both the position statement and some of your recent work with us. It was very, very helpful, and I'm sure that the viewers were appreciative of you taking the time. With that, I do want to say that the audio from today's webinar will be released on the JATcast podcast stream within the next 7 days. And so if you missed this or would like to listen to a part again or share it with a friend, it will be available there. The video will also be available on our Twitter and Facebook pages immediately after the broadcast is over, if you feel like you want to be able to catch back up with that. Also, I'd like you to just keep your eyes out for some additional new podcasts and another JAT chat that should happen later this month. And otherwise, are there any parting thoughts that you've got related to the position statement or anything that you want to make sure that viewers understand?
Make sure that they take time for themselves every day, be their own advocate, and learn to say no.
I think that's the perfect way to end for athletic trainers. Learn to say no, right? That's the most important message that we can have. For those of you that were not able to have your question answered, we do have them recorded, and I'm going to share them with Dr. Mazarol over the next week. And hopefully, if she's got time, I know we're all a little busy this time of year, she might be able to get us some short responses that we can either post on social media or respond directly to your comment that you made during this broadcast. So thank you very much for your time, and thank you for watching this evening, and that's another JAT Chat.